You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Oh, I would to thank very much the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I am very honored and proud for this unique distinction. This is historical to be the first Rabat in the world to be recognized with a citizenship.
Saudi Arabia, for one, welcomes its new robot overlords. Is the kingdom really serious about modernizing? My guests Carlotta Rabello, Chris Lord and Tom Edwards will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Catalonia's parliament votes after a fashion for independence. What happens now? Will Venezuela's fractious and fractured opposition be able to agree on how to spend the money accompanying the 2017 Sakharov Prize? And should bridge be considered a sport? Also, what even is bridge, really? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests this evening are Carlotta Rabello, Christopher Lord and Tom Edwards, all from Monocle. And we will start tonight in what fancies itself as Europe's newest nation. Earlier today, Catalonia's parliament voted in favour of declaring independence from Spain. Spain responded, unsurprisingly, by approving the imposition of direct rule from Madrid over the region. This follows the referendum held by the Catalonian government earlier this month, in which 90% of a 43% turnout were in favour of secession, but in a vote dismissed as illegal by Madrid and generally ignored by those Catalans, of whom there are many, who favour remaining part of Spain. Carlotta, first of all, the vote in Parliament was 74, that's 70, not 74 the number, 70 who were for it, 10 against, but it was massively boycotted by the opposition. So we have 70 yeses for independence from a 135 seat chamber. Is that really a mandate to cause this much disruption?
What you need to remember with Catalonia is that it's such a sensitive and issue and at the core of people's identity that you, the fact that you can't apply simply, and I put inverted commas in can't, law and numbers to it, and logic to that matter, is something that needs to be stressed. And that's why this process has been the way it's been. A lot of people blame Rajoy for the way things ended up on the state of things today. This is Prime Minister
Spanish. This is his overreaction, which I don't think anybody disputes, but to the referendum.
But at the same time, you know, could have Carles Puigdemont, the Catalan leader, acted differently? You know, people, leaders on both sides have reacted with emotion and not logic. So asking if those numbers are representative, I think in a way they are, because they do show exactly how this is an issue of passion more than anything else.
Chris, we've already seen a statement from the government of the United Kingdom that it will not recognise Catalonia. It seems fairly safe to assume that nobody else is going to either, except maybe Russia, if it feels like winding everybody up. What actually happens when they realise that nobody will recognise Catalonia, when they get thrown out of the EU, which they will, and employers start leaving, which will also happen?
Well, I suppose what happens, Andrew, is similar to what happened in Quebec when we saw the veering towards an independence referendum and an independent succession process, in as much as, you know, the banks started to say they were going to leave, the businesses started moving more people to Toronto, people started to move out. They suddenly, the reality of what that would mean to create a new Quebec state would be, you know, ultimately something that would push away business, it would essentially impoverish great vast swathes of the economy. And that will become clear if that even gets that far. What probably will happen here, as you've just observed, is that, you know, at the end of the day, very few people will recognise it. It'll be a sort of, you know, kind of a less spiky Nagorno-Karabakh situation where nobody just sits there, not really doing anything. And then in the end, there'll be an election which brings it back on side. Surely that's the only way this can go. It's sad that it's been allowed to get to where it is. That's the big concern here. And I, you know, you've got to spare a real thought here for, you know, those Catalans who didn't want this referendum to go ahead, who didn't want to vote, and who voted no to remain part of Spain. If you look at some of the statements that were made by people after this declaration of independence on the streets of Barcelona and so on, people saying things like, we're finally free. I mean, this to those people who didn't want that referendum to come along, who didn't want any of this upheaval, it must feel very isolating right now to have this decision be made in the manner that it has and create such, discord at a moment when Spain really doesn't need discord.
I found it really interesting earlier when the vote happened, the vote on direct rule in Madrid's Senate happened, that, you know, members of the Catalan party, Socialist Party, walked out of the chamber as a protest of the vote going ahead. But interestingly enough, also members from the centrist party, Ciudadans, and also from the People's Party, which is slightly more conservative, some of these MPs leaving flags, either Spanish flags or Catalan flags, in their empty seats. And it just shows that more than anything else, it's a crisis that has been so poorly managed. You know, the day after the referendum on the 1st of October in Catalonia, the speech by the king brought home the point that, yes, they had the right not to feel as he represented them all, because instead of saying, of bringing a unity speech, saying, you know, even though I don't agree with this decision, I'm here for you all, et cetera, was kind of, you know what, you should have known better, and now we're going to impose all the force on you. That's not a king that seems to be representing you.
Tom, I think we're going to see, we were talking there a few minutes ago about the potential consequences of this and how this, I guess this might be the same as we've seen here in the last year or so, as, you know, people vote for the atavistic sentimental nationalist thing and then realise that there are consequences, not all of which are manageable or desirable. One which has occurred to me this afternoon, and it's not a frivolous or actually trivial thing, is what happens when they realise that Barcelona Football Club can't play in La Liga anymore?
Well, it's just one detail that has been completely overlooked by many of the actors.
I mean, they'll win the Catalonian championship.
they should win that out of counter.
But it's not a small thing. All their great players will leave.
Well, listen. Let's wait and see how the dust settles. It, you know, it's only been announced this afternoon. I think Chris is right that there have to be regional elections, and they may end up being a de facto second referendum, but that will change the dynamics. But Carlotta was right, and I think it was telling the thing that she said about this failure, a failure to communicate ideas, a failure to manage political process, a failure, an abject failure by basically everyone, every stakeholder, to manage their own democratic obligations. No one emerges from this with any credit, to my mind. I think that the central government has handled the whole thing from being literally and metaphorically heavy-handed at the start to now so poorly. And I think the regional government as well has failed miserably. They failed to represent and reflect the views of their whole people, as Chris decided. I think it's pathetic. And I've been so disappointed by the response from without. You know, the EU has been sketchy. Other countries have been relatively sort of muted with the way that they're talking about this. It just makes me feel this is another country that's in the grip of a malaise, which is probably due principally to how poor, how inadequate the politicians themselves are. Where are our capable politicians who can actually get things done and make a compelling case to people? Wherever I look around the globe, there's none of them.
And in fact, in Spain, you've not heard, there's no conciliatory voice here. Yeah. Like, there's not even on either side of the debate anyone who says, look, you know, let's talk, let's bring each other together. Neither of them seem to want to do it.
And Tom touched upon a point that I think it's really, you know, where is the EU in all of this? The EU so far has only acted with distance. I understand to a certain extent why, because you can't have the EU interfering with internal domestic affairs of a member state. But this is a perfect opportunity not to be in favour of against, but the EU could have been the perfect mediator of this crisis, because in the end...
Carlotta, just a voice of reason. It was the same with Brexit.
No, but isn't it in the end? But with Brexit, you have a member state rebelling against the EU, so the EU is automatically to one side. With this, it would be the chance to be a mediator in the sense, you know, the EU is created as this beacon of democracy. It's just upholding their own values. If they can flag their own flag, who will?
Okay, well, we will doubtless be following that story as it unfolds over the coming days and weeks. We will move along now. There are a few more fun ways, I think, to make a nuisance of yourself on the international stage than by instituting a prize that rewards good behaviour. The European Parliament figured this out some while back by establishing the Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought, annoying Russia from the outset by naming it after their dissident physicist. The 2017 Sakharov Prize has been awarded to the opposition of Venezuela. Or the opposition in Venezuela. Tom Edwards, do we assume that this was decided before the Venezuelan opposition all fell spectacularly out with each other and divided into the People's Front of Venezuela and the Venezuelan People's Front and so on?
Very possibly. And I think there's a depressing refrain which will be familiar from the conversation we just completed, which is, you know, it's all well and good doing gesture politics, you know, tokenism. We talk about that quite often. But you need to be a bit more robust and you need to have the conviction to make pronouncements that, you know, maybe that could harm you in terms of PR, that could be damaging, that could upset people. Because if you're going to make a stand on something, you need to be invested in a decision. Everyone always says this idea of skin in the game. But that's what, you know, the European bloc needs to show here. All well and good and all too easy to bestow a historic award on a group and say, you know, this is recognition for the validity of your cause. But if you don't back that up by, for example, hitting the opponents of that award, the opponents of that reward with, you know, in the pocket, then you're not really doing all you can. I think we need to see a much more concerted campaign, really, by the likes of the people who are influencing these sorts of awards to actually affect positive change. We should be a bit bolder. I'm surprised, frankly, that there haven't been a more robust position taken by some of those stakeholders against Venezuela, because it's not like there's a fear, as we sometimes see with Russia or China or the States, that you don't want to sort of tweak the nose of the bear. This is a country that should be told how it is.
Well, to be fair, Antonio Tajani, the president of the European Parliament, he has said he wants to bring these sanctions in, and Spain, out of all the member states, has been an advocate for these sanctions from the beginning, mainly because of the relations between the two nations. But with the EU, we need to remember, when these sanctions being brought by the European Parliament, 27 countries have to agree. It's not by majority, it needs to be a unanimous vote. And getting 27 countries to agree on something as massive as this, how it will harm trade with them, or etc., or bilateral relations, whatever, that's what is tricky. But I just can't understand, with such a big PR and communications department, how no one thought that awarding, you know, a humanitarian prize 2 months after we gave a press conference saying we're not raising sanctions, we're just putting pressure on Maduro, whatever that means, that no one would be able to connect the two. And yes, it's a noble cause. And it's not only Venezuela's National Assembly that's being awarded, but also all the political prisoners listed by Foro Penal, the humanitarian think tank. And that's obviously a noble cause. But you need to measure the level of hypocrisy of who's awarding it.
Chris, do awards like this, or does this award in particular, put pressure on somebody like President Nicolas Maduro, or does it yet further his narrative that he and Venezuela are beset by treacherous forces without conspiring against the country, etc., etc.?
Unfortunately, Andrew, I don't want to be sort of too negative about it, because, yeah, it's good to recognise those people who are fighting for some kind of, you know, semblance of democracy there in Venezuela. But as Carlotta and Tom have both said, I mean, the fact that there aren't, that those sanctions have not come into place, that have been discussed before, and that we're still in a situation where they're not there, then, of course, it doesn't. And we have to remember, you know, this is given, you know, it's a fair old price. It's in the realms of sort of about €50,000 that goes to an assembly. What does that actually do? I mean, what does that actually do to help them help push democracy forward? I mean, I wonder if, you know, if rather than doing this, you've got over there actual political parties, political individuals who, you know, we've had one which has been, you know, languishing in jail for God knows for 4 years, who was let out on house arrest. You have another one who's barred from running for president, and Capri, as this would be, is not actually able to participate in democracy at all. I mean, I wonder if rather than giving prizes to something a little bit abstract, like an assembly, where what happens next? Maybe, you know, if the European Parliament wants to step in and do something, maybe actually needs to create some sort of forum to bring those disparate elements of the opposition together. If what they're saying is we need to remove Maduro, but the only way to remove Maduro is through democracy, then perhaps they need to go and actually look at those people who are going to potentially try and run against him and bring him over and create some kind of, you know, overseas platform to bring this actually quite divided opposition together. Awarding money to a body that has largely been superseded by the president's own pet assembly doesn't seem to do that much in favour of democracy, I would argue.
But it's important to note as well how it's not exclusive to this award. You know, the Nobel Peace Prize has been marred by controversies like this for, you know, what's the purpose of it all? And we had conversations here on this very program about it. And, you know, this idea that it's an award more in hopes of what you would do rather than action, like when President Obama won in hopes that he would end the war in Afghanistan. And then 2 months later, he sends 30,000 troops extra to the ground. And it's just like, should we be rewarding your hopes for a good man or woman, or actual action, someone that actually has done good? To think that Gandhi was nominated and never won it, I think is a perfect example of how these awards can easily become just a symbol for the wrong thing.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Carlotta Ribello, Tom Edwards and Chris Lord. Coming up next, Saudi Arabia, Gaza's spacewood.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Carlotta Ribello, Tom Edwards and Chris Lord. And let's look at Saudi Arabia, which, as some analysts see it, is embarked upon a bold programme of reform which may yet drag it into the early 20th century. Not content with grudgingly permitting women to drive and floating the suggestion that perhaps its interpretation of Islam has erred towards the over-enthusiastic, Saudi Arabia has announced some expansive investments, including $500 million in a new economic free zone and $1 billion in Richard Branson's privateer space program Virgin Galactic. And as we heard at the top of the show, they didn't build the robot, in fairness. That was a robot from Hong Kong that was appearing at a thing, but Saudi Arabia decided to make it the world's first robot citizen, prompting the inevitable responses. There were people in Saudi Arabia who actually got angry because the robot, which was nominally female, was not veiled or accompanied by a man. And there were other people who got angry that the robot, which was not veiled or accompanied by a man, was allowed to do that, of course, and face no sanction, which, of course, an actual human Saudi female, no, it's not a tautology, that's fine, would not have been allowed to, thereby suggesting that the robot from Hong Kong is, in fact, more of a citizen than any Saudi woman. Tom, first of all, Saudi Arabia is still away from getting with the programme, I think we've learned, haven't we?
Well, there have been some extraordinary stories in the last few days about various kind of Gulf states and powerhouses in this region trying to sort of show a different face to the world. And to pick up on, again, a theme we've been talking about, which is how not to manage stories and how not to do public relations. We've had a bit of a primer. This is completely extraordinary. And, you know, there are some profound questions about, you know, What does Saudi Arabia want? What does it want to be? What kind of a country does it want to be? Is it interested in any democratic processes? Is it interested in securing its citizens' rights? Is it interested in actually changing? And how's it going to navigate some potentially existential questions in terms of how the kingdom is financed?
Like what happens when they don't have enough oil to buy everybody off anymore?
The structure, and I mean, Chris knows much more about this and will explain to you, but, you know, this is a country that's burning through its reserves. It's putting pressure. It's under great pressure. And, you know, these ideas about transitional economic zones and pouring money, you know, they're sort of skirting around some much more profound questions. Now, of course, it's funny, and I try and imagine in my mind what a robot veil might look like. But it actually, it's not really funny. And if you think about the privations that many people suffer there, for example, for being female or for doing something or behaving or indulging in a lifestyle that is not prescribed by the state, it's pretty alarming. And I don't know. Carlos was talking about it before. How do they not see that there'll be some sort of discord from the way this story is told around the world? It's incredible to me that there's not a more, I don't know, enlightened public-facing pronouncement.
Could it be because there's not, you know, the brother robot or the father robot? Because it can't be just any male companion. It has to be a very specific one.
We're getting lots of interesting questions then about how you define which robots are related to other robots.
Exactly. How do you do that? I mean, it's astonishing when you think about women around the world trying to, you know, not be as undermined as they are in nations such as Saudi Arabia, can be more assertive, stand your ground, become a robot. I don't think has ever crossed anyone's mind.
It may be a way forward. Chris, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has recently been reported as describing Saudi Arabia as not normal and said he wanted to return it to moderate Islam. Now, moderate, of course, is one of those infuriatingly relative phrases. What do we think he means by moderate?
So Mohammed bin Salman's a pretty interesting case here. He, of course, being the crown prince, the guy who's basically spearheading this whole process of reform when it comes to some of the crazy laws that Saudi Arabia does have. When he says moderate, you know, as you mentioned, Andrew, it's a wonderfully vague word. It means we can sort of apply lots of different meanings to it. So your religious people will say, oh, okay, he's just been a little bit more moderate.
Because we hear this a lot in terms of Iran. When you describe somebody as a moderate, it means he doesn't actually think women should be flogged for singing in public.
But then, I mean, of course, you have to remember Hassan Rouhani is regularly described as a moderate, but by and large does not really have moderate views. I mean, he's still
not as we would understand them, certainly.
He's still an adherent of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He wants it to still have mandatory laws with regards to hijab and so on and so forth. And the same goes, I think, for Mohammed bin Salman. I think here, you know, we have to remember a couple of things with Saudi, is that ultimately the monarchy is at the behest of the clergy. So whatever the clergy wants, they have to do as they're told, essentially. In as much as if they go too far with these reforms, the clergy can come in and whip up all kinds of fury in society. That is ultimately the custodian of the two holy mosques, and therefore you have the two most powerful imams in the whole of Islam. So that is very important to understand, is that constantly they're having to manage the conservative demands of those clerics and so on. So that's quite important to say. However, what I find shocking with this whole thing is that we saw in over the summer, you know, Saudis say women can finally drive for the first time. But at the same time, as we've just discussed with regards to this whole robot fiasco, they can't leave the country unless a guardian gives them the sign-off to leave. So what I'm saying is what I think Saudi is trying to do is embark on this insane program of restituting the terrible image that it does have around the world. But unfortunately, they keep getting it wrong over and over again.
Well, I think it was also the fact, and I'll ask you what you make of this, Carlotta, it's the fact that they make announcements like, we're going to let women drive cars, and then kind of it seems like they're expecting a round of applause.
Well, and they can only take the driver's license with the male companion, so still, it's not immediate. So, yeah, they're expecting a pat on the back, and well done, we love you now. I'm sorry, but years of wrongdoing don't get turned with just one nice press release.
And they pour money into these PR hubs all through the UK, through London and Europe and so on. And at the same time, they're engaged in a devastating proxy war in Yemen. I mean, this stuff doesn't match up. And then you see this robot thing coming out of you know, a robot coming out and saying that she's a citizen of Saudi Arabia. And at the same time,
you just want to say tough break, robot. You know?
She never saw that coming.
You could have picked.
But it's saddening to think is that at the same time, you know, it has almost no industry other than petrochemicals. I mean, there doesn't produce anything else. It doesn't really have any sort of exports, any kind of technology industry. And sort of bringing in, you know, the fact that the robot was even built in Hong Kong, I mean, they've just bought it in. I mean, we're going to see the UAE in the next month or so open the Louvre Abu Dhabi. And I mean, if I wanted to be really cynical, we could say it's basically another talking robot, isn't it? It's something else that's been bought in from overseas to make the place look good.
Chris, one thing that interests me, we talk about, you know, how do you do moderate? What does moderate mean? And if we're looking at sort of hubbism, whatever you want to call it, is there, can there be a moderate system. I mean, are there countries that show a way that, that Saudi could follow in practical terms? Or is to try and talk about moderate Wahhabism almost a contradiction in terms?
I mean, the thing with any talk of moderateness would be quite simply that it's almost impossible to do because the conservative members of society will demand something very different all the time.
Well, finally tonight, and for something completely different, British bridge players who voted Leave last year, which, let's face it, was all of them, will be feeling a measure of vindication. Will be feeling a measure of vindication today after the European Court of Justice ruled that the popular card game is not a sport. The decision, which denies the English Bridge Union access to lottery funding and certain tax exemptions, was rooted in the ECJ's failure to believe that bridge met the definition of sport, or their definition, i.e. proof of benefit to physical or mental well-being. Does anyone here actually know how to play bridge? I mean, we're actually set up for it. We are four people sat around a table. It could be me and Tom versus Carlotta and Chris.
Before I Googled this morning, had no idea.
Their definition of sport, Tom, the ECJ said, is that a weird definition? Proof of benefit to physical or mental well-being? I mean, there's plenty of sports that are actually demonstrably detrimental to physical and mental well-being.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty grey area. And there are a lot of countries, even within Europe, who have... This all comes down, of course, to tax purposes. I was actually chatting with someone from the British Bridge Association earlier today.
Bridge Union. Is that a rival body?
No, that's the one. Sorry, I made an error. But the question is, should you pay VAT on entering bridge events? Because if it's sport, you don't pay VAT. And they've obviously lost that case, and this thrown up this whole thing. I mean, it's incomprehensible to me, which would suggest that there's certain amounts of mental gymnastics you need to go
through.
But if
bridge is a sport, isn't, you know, Cluedo or snakes and ladders?
Possibly. I don't know whether there's the same kind of intellectual rigour from what would be termed just a board game. However, on this broader point about
sport... I think Snap would make a great Olympic sport.
Well, there are many things. I mean, if you look at the sportsmen or women who play the game, I would imagine that bridge participants are certainly... well, probably on balance, healthier than, for example, darts players. And that's definitely a sport. And is it doing them any physical good? Not by the looks of it.
And I love how the English Bridge Union said that it was really sad by this decision because it's going to affect the way people play bridge in Britain. How? How it will it?
They're
will
just
going to
play more angrily from now on.
Well, see, the thing. My definition of sport is that it should carry with it the significant risk of physical injury. But having talked about this with friends of mine who do play bridge, they one of them did reply, "You should see the state of my shins after an evening in which you've done something to upset your partner." So they may have a point in that respect. But Chris, come on, this is silly, really, isn't it?
It is silly. Yeah, I'm pretty Saudi about the sports that get. get welcomed into these things. No, you know, I'm not into this idea of making poker an Olympic sport. I'm not into this idea of making, you know, squats or tiddlywinks.
Can I just throw in, the IOC does recognise bridge as a sport.
But it's since 1998.
But not an Olympic sport. It's not actually played sport. At the Olympics.
As a sport.
And we know they have a certain moral flexibility about this and a number of other things.
So in answer to your question, Andrew, no, I'm not into it. I don't think that these things should be, certainly not welcomed into the Olympics. It obviously has this whole other tax dimension, but I'm pretty conservative when it comes to what I
recognise. What is your definition of what you recognise as a sport?
I think your definition is pretty good. It's like, does it have some physical risk to you? Good.
What is wrong with you two?
No, come on, this is good.
It's called living vicariously. Through the deeds of skillful and courageous than myself.
Needs to have some sort of, you know, physical risk, but remaining entertaining. So when it crosses that line into, you know, gladiators,
let me throw you in the option. What about, because we had chess boxing. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
You play 5 minutes of time chess.
I'm against that as well.
Chess, and then you would have a round of fighting. Let's mix them together.
No, just play chess or
bridge,
do boxing.
Bridge, basketball. There's probably a very good name out there.
Well, you have in Finland wife carrying. That's a sport.
Bridge wife carrying.
Do they?
Yeah,
wife carrying's a thing.
They could mix it with football and you'd have a foot bridge.
Wife carrying cheese rolling. Isn't that the other one? Rolling cheese down a hill. Can combine the two.
What, you're suggesting like running down a hill chasing cheeses while carrying your wife?
That can go down well.
You just need to come up with a name for that sport, and you too could apply for recognition from the IOC. I'm not quite sure how that conversation got to that point, but it did. In 4 minutes dead, it's almost impressive. That does bring us probably mercifully to the end of tonight's show. Carlotta Ribello, Tom Edwards, and Chris Lord, thank you all for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Henry Rees-Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next, 1900, Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. We'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.